Syrian strike on Tuesday, in which 18 allied fighters were killed after they'd been mistakenly identified as ISIS troops.
Scott, let me ask if there's a comparison to be made between the dropping of this weapon in Afghanistan and the Syria bombing. In each case, is it true that this makes a headline, but it doesn't really change the basic situation? I mean, the general in Afghanistan says this is a tactical decision to use this particular weapon.
Steve, I remember back in 2001, you were in Afghanistan, and I was sort of back filling your old job at the Pentagon, and I remember reporting at that time on what was then the largest conventional weapon that U.S. military forces had dropped. It was dropped at that time on Taliban forces. I think the fact that we are still bombing Afghanistan 16 years later suggests that weapons like this, for all their demonstrated power, are not always decisive.
Okay. Scott Horsley, thanks very much. Really appreciate it.
Good to be with you, Steve.
That's NPR White House correspondent Scott Horsley. And let's turn now to a military story closer to home. Investigation of a veterans hospital found chaos. The Secretary of Veterans Affairs replaced the head of the medical center in Washington, which serves 100,000 patients. He acted after a report by VA Inspector General Michael Missel, who's on the line to talk about this. Inspector General, welcome to the program.
Thanks for having me, Steve.
How bad is it at this one hospital?
We found a number of serious and troubling deficiencies at the medical center. Among the more significant things we found is there were no effective inventory system for managing the availability of medical equipment and supplies used for patient care. No effective system to ensure supplies and equipment, which were subject to patient recalls, were not used on patients. Over $150 million in equipment or supplies that had not been inventoried in the past year, therefore had not been accounted for. We also found a large off-site warehouse full of non-inventory equipment and materials with a lease expiring at the end of this month and with no plan to move the materials. Also, 18 of 25 sterile satellite storage areas that we reviewed we found were dirty. And finally, there were numerous and critical open staff positions that will make proper remediation of these matters very difficult.
Inspector General, I want to try to underline what the stakes were here, because when you say a phrase like no effective inventory system, some people's eyes might glaze over a little bit. It might be hard to grasp why that's even all that important. But I suppose we're talking about a situation where you may need medical supplies urgently and not know how to find them. Were people's lives actually at stake here?
We found that there was a serious risk to patients. Let me give you a couple of examples to really drive this home. In March, the medical center ran out of bloodlines for dialysis patients. So therefore, they had to go to another medical center to get the bloodline so that dialysis services could be given. We also found while we were on site that the tubes used to give oxygen to patients in need were out of certain supply rooms, and people had to scurry around the hospital to get it. And then there was also problems in the operating room where procedures had to be either postponed or canceled because they didn't have the proper equipment to do the operation as safely as it should have been done.
Do you suspect that people died as a result of this?
I don't have any evidence of that at this time. Our work is continuing, and we're going to look very carefully to see if there was any adverse patient outcomes.
You know, Inspector General Missel, every now and again, of course, there's been a scandal at a VA medical facility, and now we have this one at the medical center in Washington, D.C. And when we hear about them, at least from the outside, it often sounds like mainly a question of management. In this case, you're talking about an ability to get storerooms cleaned properly, an ability to have a proper inventory system. Does the VA tend to attract good managers?
I think they have a number of dedicated employees who are trying to do the best job they can for veterans. One thing we're going to be looking at very closely in this report, because our work is continuing, we've only been on the site about 2 weeks, is to determine why this happened and also the root cause of the issue, so that if there is management challenges and problems, we're going to identify them very clearly.
Your report doesn't even just talk about a lack of good management, a lack of management. You write there numerous and critical open senior staff positions. Is it hard to find anybody at all to do these jobs?
It's always challenging to hire people, but as I said, given the mission of so important to help veterans who so richly deserve the services and benefits that VA has to offer, there are many people who would love to work there. The issue, though, is making sure you have the right people in the right jobs and the right system to manage those people.
Is the situation stable now?
We don't know if it's stable. We know that the secretary has made changes, and they're working hard to do so. We made 8 recommendations to get the facility back to the stage we think is appropriate, and we hope they implement them promptly.
Inspector General Missel, thanks very much.
Thank you so much.
Michael Missel is the Inspector General of the Department of Veterans Affairs, which has just looked into conditions at the Washington, D.C. Medical Center.
You know, you can pretty much get anything delivered these days. Coffee pods, ink toner, ramen noodles, and now poetry. Subscribe to his service and Matthias Svalina will write you a poem every day for a month and deliver it to your doorstep each morning by bicycle.
I try to write a unique poem for each subscriber every day. I like the idea of building an intimate relationship with the reader over the course of a month.
We caught up with Svalina in Austin, Texas. He moves to a different city each month. And to get his poems out before dawn, the pedaling poet gets up at 3 in the morning. This month, he is riding 35 miles.
The streets are empty. My headlamp is illuminating little bits of the street. And I bike from house to house and apartment building to condo, walk up to the front door and leave a little pink envelope in people's doors.
And we're talking about personalized stuff here. Every poem is written for the person who subscribes to his delivery service, people who have found him on the internet or maybe through word of mouth. Most he has never met. Svalina calls his works dream poems. They feel like a stream of consciousness.
So I've published 5 books of poems, and those I spend years sometimes editing and reworking and trying to meticulously get correct. These dreams, I write as quickly as I can, and then they usually escape my memory almost immediately, and they're ephemeral, and they're not mine. They belong to whoever subscribed them.
As for subscribing, he charges $45 for a month of poems. Of course, he wrote one for us for no charge.
When you fit a key into a nonsense newspaper, the newspaper falls apart into dust. When you fit a key into a normal newspaper, a bit of light fills the dark tunnel that you're in. You realize it's not a tunnel at all, but a home you recognize, on a street you recognize, in the neighborhood in which you live.
Kind of like that. That is door-to-door poet Matthias Svalina. This is NPR News.
And it is 8:18. You're listening to Morning Edition on Wisconsin Public Radio. Up next, we'll bring you news live from NPR and WPR. We have breaking news that Janesville fugitive Joseph Jakubowski has been captured in Wisconsin. More on that story in a couple of minutes.
Support for WGTD comes from Andrea's. For over 100 years, we've been celebrating spring with the finest in Easter treats. From our famous Pecton jelly beans to our solid milk and dark chocolate bunnies, we will assemble the perfect Easter basket for your loved ones. AndreasGifts.com.
Wendinger, an après-moi le déluge from composer Luna Pearl Wolf. WPR is proud to promote live performance. For more information, go to WPR.org/events.
From NPR News in Washington, I'm Jim Kane. A North Korean official says his country is ready to launch a preemptive strike of its own if the U.S. shows any signs of military aggression. In an interview with the Associated Press, Vice Foreign Minister Hong Sang-nyeol says through a translator that a North Korean nuclear test will occur if and when the country's leaders decide it's necessary.
As for the nuclear test, it's something that our Supreme Headquarters decides.
The vice minister says President Trump's tweets are adding fuel to what he called a vicious cycle of tensions on the Korean Peninsula. Police in Rome are increasing security for Good Friday ceremonies. The city's been on high alert during Holy Week following recent terror attacks targeting Christians, as Christopher Livesay reports.
Police with bomb-sniffing dogs are checking every trash can and sewer drain around the Colosseum and other areas Pope Francis will say the Stations of the Cross. But elsewhere in the city, you can see soldiers with automatic rifles and armored trucks at virtually every major tourist site, from the Trevi Fountain to the train stations.
A federal judge in San Francisco hears arguments today in the first suit against President Trump's order withholding federal funds from communities that refuse to cooperate with immigration authorities. The Commerce Department says retail sales fell 0.2% last month as Americans spent less, especially at auto dealers and restaurants. Consumer prices, meanwhile, fell 0.3% in March, the biggest drop in 3 years. I'm Jim Kane, NPR News in Washington.
This is Wisconsin Public Radio News at 8:20. I'm Maureen McCollum. Janesville fugitive Joseph Jakubowski has been captured in Vernon County. The Rock County Sheriff's Department says he was found camping on a farm in Reedstown this morning. Law enforcement took him into custody without incident. Jakubowski is suspected of robbing a gun store in southern Wisconsin and sending an anti-government manifesto to the White House. Dozens of police and federal officials have been searching for Jakubowski since the gun store was robbed in Janesville last Tuesday. We'll have more information on this developing story throughout the morning. Two western Wisconsin frac sand mines have been sold to an Oklahoma-based company as the industry responds to growing demand. Mammoth Energy Services purchased Taylor Frac of Jackson County and Chieftain Sands of Barron County as part of deals totaling more than $160 million. The company says this will bring their capacity to more than 4 million tons of sand per year. Samir Nangia is an oil field services analyst with IHS.
We are hearing a lot more about basically mines coming out of being mothballed, basically going back to active status.
A statement from Mammoth says drillers are optimistic with oil prices around $50 a barrel. Nangia says frac sand demand is up nearly 50% compared with last year. In baseball, Ryan Braun and Eric Thames homered. Jimmy Nelson turned in his second straight strong start, and the Brewers beat the Cincinnati Reds 5-1 last night. This is WPR.
Support for NPR comes from NPR member stations and from the financial services firm of Raymond James, offering personalized wealth management advice and banking and capital markets expertise, along with a legacy of putting clients' financial well-being first. Learn more at RaymondJames.com. From Visit St. Petersburg Clearwater, home of 35 miles of white sand beaches along Florida's Gulf Coast, and a daily sunset celebration on Clearwater Beach, 90 minutes west of Orlando. At visitstpeteclearwater.com. And from Tate's Bake Shop, whose founder Kathleen King started selling her handmade chocolate chips from her dad's farm stand in the Hamptons as a child. Now it markets nationwide. Gift baskets are at tatesbakeshop.com.
It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Steve Inskeep.
And I'm David Green, and let's return to the story of the Rohingya. They're a Muslim minority group in Buddhist-majority Myanmar, and they have been persecuted by that country's government for decades, so much so that many flee for something better somewhere else. Sometimes they go by boat south toward Malaysia, or they go across the border into neighboring Bangladesh. By some estimates, there are now more than 500,000 Rohingya stranded in Bangladesh, which has grudgingly offered them refuge, but not acceptance. As Michael Sullivan reports from southern Bangladesh, local patience is wearing thin.
I'm walking down what will soon be the new highway that will link this place, Teknaf, with its beautiful beaches on the Bay of Bengal, with Cox's Bazaar, 50 miles up the road. And the developers have already staked out their claims alongside the road for when this road gets finished. And that's what the Bangladeshi government is hoping for. They're hoping that this will be the new beach tourist destination.
Okay. How much?
Until then, Cox's Bazaar will have to do. And it has its charms. A terrifying jet ski ride, for instance, on what's billed as the world's longest beach. And there's parasailing and pony rides, too. But it's still very much a work in progress. Getting to the beachside hotels can be a challenge on roads packed with rickshaws, motorbikes, and really big buses on really narrow streets. But they're working on it. And Lieutenant Colonel Anwar Ul Islam, who heads the Cox's Bazaar Development Authority,
has big plans, starting with a new airport.
We look forward to tourists from all over the world. We have a goal to attract them. Yeah, that's why the airport is going to be the international airport.
So you're building a newer, bigger airport to accommodate more flights and bigger planes?
Bigger planes, yeah.
And if that happens, he says, he's confident the foreign tourists will come, that Cox's Bazar will give Thailand and the Philippines a run for their money and bring badly needed jobs and investment in a country of more than 150 million that hasn't enough of either.
Yes, definitely, definitely.
But there's a problem. Almost all of those Rohingya refugees, they live in and around here. Not a big selling point for a go-to tourist destination. And the colonel knows it.
It is an issue. Actually, the government has decided if we can relocate this Rohingya to another places, it will be better.
Better for the Rohingya if they get to a third country like they want, and better for Bangladesh too. Until then, they're stuck here, not allowed to move or even work, not legally anyway. This is a brick factory, a short drive from Cox's Bazar. The brickmaking here, labor-intensive. The workers shaping, drying, then baking the bricks that help fuel the construction boom in Cox's Bazar. The factory manager, Shah Jahan, says he hires Rohingya for the nastiest jobs, hauling the coal to bake the bricks.
We don't recruit them. If they come looking for work and we need people, we give them a job.
He's even given one Rohingya a permanent job as a mechanic to keep the ovens cooking. Hassan, we're only using his first name because he's not supposed to be working here, is 30 years old and fled here 2 years ago fearing arrest in Myanmar. And this job, he says, is the best he's had since he came here.
The last job I had, the boss tried to cheat me and didn't give me my full salary. He told me if I complained, he'd have someone hurt me. So I left and came here.
Hassan says he sends about half the $100 a month he earns back to his family still living in Myanmar. But many locals think he shouldn't even have a job as a refugee. At a nearby construction site, we meet two, Habibur Rahman and Alauddin.
We compete for the same jobs. The more of them that come, the less opportunities we have to work and to make money. They'll also work for half the wages we get.
Alauddin is more blunt.
Our country is already poor. We don't need any more Rohingya coming here and making it worse. Not all Rohingya are bad. Some are good, but they still take our jobs. And some are involved in the illegal drug trade too.
And not just the drug trade. Some analysts worry a newly formed Rohingya insurgent group could start recruiting in the camps here and use them as a staging area for attacks into Myanmar. In this video uploaded to YouTube, one of the group's alleged leaders calls for a Rohingya uprising against the Myanmar military. If that happens, it could prompt another furious response from the military and another wave of refugees. This might help explain the Bangladeshi government's announcement in January. It was going ahead with plans to relocate the Rohingya refugees to a remote island some 3 hours away by boat. That announcement caused alarm in the international aid community and fear among the Rohingya.
They don't want to go to the island of Tengachar.
Abul Qasim is an unlikely advocate for the Rohingya, a Bangladeshi human rights activist who runs the NGO Help Cox's Bazar.
Who would want to be sent to an island where the water swells up and people cannot live? None of them are willing to go to Tengachar.
He's sympathetic to his countrymen's complaints about competition for scarce resources, but he's more sympathetic to the Rohingya's plight.
They neither get support in their country, nor can they feel at home here in this country. They are really vulnerable. They are deprived of all their rights of education, country, religion, and language. They're deprived of everything.
The Rohingya have no good options, he says. Stay in squalid camps here, barely surviving, or risk returning home to Myanmar and retribution from the military. Of the 70,000 who fled since October, only a handful have chosen to go back. For NPR News, I'm Michael Sullivan in Cox's Bazar, Bangladesh.
And our series on the Rohingya this week was produced by Ashley Westerman. You can find more of that reporting on the Rohingya and photos from their trip to southern Bangladesh at npr.org. It's Morning Edition from NPR News.
Bob Mankoff has edited the New Yorker's cartoons for two decades.
My targets are either myself or people like me. I don't punch down, I don't punch up, I elbow to the side.
Next month, he steps aside, but he says he's not done with humor for good. I'm Audie Cornish, the New Yorker's Bob Mankoff, this afternoon on All Things Considered from NPR News. All Things Considered from 4 to 6:30 today here on Wisconsin Public Radio. Good morning. It is 8:30. You're listening to Morning Edition on WPR. I'm Maureen McCollum. Still to come this hour, it's Wisconsin Life. Today we'll hear reflections on motherhood. That's Wisconsin Life in about 15 minutes. In Wisconsin news, Janesville fugitive Joseph Jakubowski has been captured in Vernon County. The Rock County Sheriff's Department said he was found camping on a farm in Reedstown this morning. Law enforcement took him into custody without incident. Jakubowski is suspected of robbing a gun store in southern Wisconsin and sending an anti-government manifesto to the White House. Dozens of police and federal officials have been searching for Jakubowski since the gun store was robbed in Janesville last week. Only half of Wisconsin's congressional delegation have confirmed they're holding a public town hall meeting during lawmakers' two-week recess from Washington, D.C. Green Bay Congressman Mike Gallagher is among those not holding town halls. Speaking on WPR's Joy Cardine show this week, Gallagher said he's focusing on meeting as many people as possible one-on-one.
What's helpful for me to just get people's thoughts on whether it's on health care, whether it's on foreign policy. I find I learn a lot.
Speaker Paul Ryan and Congresswoman Gwen Moore also confirmed they will not hold town halls during the break. Town halls across the country have been well attended and sometimes contentious in recent months as voters were riled over issues, including the possible repeal of the Affordable Care Act. You're listening to Wisconsin Public Radio News.
Support for Wisconsin Public Radio comes from Kimberly-Clark Corporation, home of Kleenex, Huggies, and Kotex brands. More information about Kimberly-Clark's 144-year history is available on the web at kimberly-clark.com.
Support comes from the App Factory at UW Parkside. Is your business or nonprofit in need of a mobile app? Student interns at the App Factory make state-of-the-art and user-friendly apps for phones and other mobile devices. Web applications, too. For more information, visit appfactory.uwp.edu.
There's a chance of rain showers throughout the day today in Wisconsin and a slight chance of thunderstorms this afternoon. Highs will be near 60 degrees, except in the lower to mid-60s near Lake Superior. And tonight, rain showers are likely, paired with a chance of thunderstorms. Lows will be in the lower to mid-50s, except in the mid to upper 40s near Lake Superior.
Support for NPR comes from NPR member stations. And from 23andMe, a personalized genetic service dedicated to helping people understand what their 23 pairs of chromosomes can tell them about their health, traits, and ancestry. Learn more at 23andMe.com. From Linda Mood Bell, committed to helping all students learn to their potential, offering a spring open house this month for information on programs for reading, comprehension, and math. Learn more at LindaMoodBell.com. And from the Kresge Foundation at Kresge.org.
It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Steve Inskeep.
And I'm David Green. This is the holiest week on the Christian calendar, and yet some Christians will not be celebrating. Egypt's Coptic Christians were the victims of horrific attacks this week. Suicide bombings at churches in two cities on Palm Sunday killed nearly 50 people and caused Egypt's president to declare a state of emergency. Those churches will not hold celebrations after tomorrow night's Easter services. Coptic Christians have been around since the dawn of Christianity. Almost all of them live in Egypt. They are a minority in a Muslim-dominated country. They have often been persecuted, and now they seem to be a special target of Islamic State militants. The General Bishop of the Coptic Orthodox Church in the United Kingdom, Bishop Angelos, spoke with us from London. He was born in Egypt and is in constant contact with the Coptic community there. Well, let me start by saying I'm so sorry about what your community in Egypt has been through. This has been quite a tragic week.
It has been. It's I've said in past weeks, in response to other things that have happened, that at times like this we see the very worst and very best of humanity, because we see one person or a group of people wanting to cause pain and terror, while there are so many acts of graciousness and kindness that happen. But we're very blessed to have so many people praying for us.
What do you tell people in Egypt who are concerned about the state of emergency that the president has declared, suggesting that maybe this is giving the government too much power?
What I say to them is, please don't confuse issues. We're still burying our dead and we're still ministering to their families, and not to turn this into a political argument. My biggest concern during these days is that there is an immediate desire to politicize everything that happens. And so Christians really just become collateral damage, whereas we start speaking about states of emergency and security.
So the Islamic State has claimed responsibility for these bombings. Do you believe that they were behind this?
The political grandstanding and point scoring that comes from people declaring that they have done this or that doesn't really impress me, neither does it concern me. I think the important thing is to realize that we keep the focus on those who have lost their lives and those who continue to be victims, rather than giving the focus to those who want this kind of coverage.
But Bishop, if we listen to people who follow and study ISIS, that they say that their goal in Egypt might be to create religious strife and really divide and undermine the country. Are you seeing signs of that? Are you worried about that?
I think that groups like this actually have a more sinister plan. I think what we're seeing now is a plan to actually eradicate Christians. I think there is an immense intolerance by these people and their followers felt towards Christians in Egypt. They feel that they have no place, or indeed if they're going to be there, they should live as a protected community, not as equal citizens.
If that is indeed true, if the elimination of, or at least the isolation of your community is the goal, what is that like day to day for Coptic Christians in Egypt?
It's interesting that these attacks happened in full churches. We had the bombing of St. Peter's Church in Cairo only a few months ago. Mm-hmm. And yet Christians still keep going to church, still keep publicly proclaiming and living their faith. They're not dissuaded. All that happens is they walk out of their homes every day feeling vulnerable and feeling that they are a target.
Now, as we were wrapping up our chat, I asked Bishop Angelos if he had anything he wanted to add, and he did. He offered this thought.
One of the very clear defining factors of Christians in Egypt over the past years, as we've seen them suffer these ongoing attacks, is their spirit of forgiveness and their spirit of resilience. And I think that in itself speaks volumes.
Do you forgive the suicide bombers who carried out these attacks?
Absolutely, absolutely. I don't have to forgive the act, because the act was vicious and it was evil. But we're all humans, we're all under the brokenness of sin, and we all have a possibility to repent. We are very happy to continue loving and forgiving and hoping. And I think this is the only way to break a really sinister spiral of violence that has swept across the Middle East.
Bishop Angelos, thank you so much for your time.
Thank you, and every blessing and good Easter to all your listeners.
Now let's remember a powerful influence on pro football from David's home city of Pittsburgh.
Yeah, it's a sad, sad morning in Pittsburgh. Dan Rooney has died at age 84. He was chairman of the Pittsburgh Steelers, the architect of those championship teams.
But the job title alone, as David knows, does not get across his full influence on his city and his league. NPR's Tom Goldman has more.
Dan Rooney was the rare man of power and influence who never forgot to be kind as well. Rooney's dad, Art, founded the Pittsburgh Steelers, and Dan grew up around the team and its players. Over the years, Dan Rooney held a number of front office jobs, and it was under his leadership that the team became a 1970s dynasty, winning 4 Super Bowl titles in 6 years and 2 more since 2006. Rooney was equally influential with the league. He helped settle labor disputes with a calm and quiet demeanor. Joe Horrigan is with the Pro Football Hall of Fame, which inducted Rooney in 2000.
He was this consensus builder who behind the scenes could, you know, just appeal to common sense.
In 1933, Art Rooney's new NFL team in Pittsburgh signed one of only 2 black players in the league. 70 years later, Dan Rooney was the driving force behind the Rooney Rule. It says teams have to interview at least 1 minority candidate when hiring a new head coach or general manager. Dan Rooney talked about it in 2012.
There was really very few, down to either none or 1. Minority coaches, and we just felt that this was not the right thing. It was not the right thing from many, many standpoints.
The tributes following Rooney's death have ranged from former President Obama, who appointed Rooney ambassador to Ireland, to players. In an Instagram post, Pittsburgh All-Pro wide receiver Antonio Brown spoke for countless Steelers over the years when he wrote, "You looked at me as more than just another jersey number, one of the most genuine and humble human beings I've had the pleasure of knowing. This season, the number 84 on my uniform will represent the 84 years you spent on this earth, making an impact on the lives of others." Tom Goldman, NPR News.
This is NPR News.
It is 8:41, and you are listening to Morning Edition on Wisconsin Public Radio. Coming up next, we'll bring you the news from NPR and WPR. After that, it's Wisconsin Life. And in 10 minutes on Morning Edition, Oscar-winning screenwriter John Ridley talks about his new series, which is set in the UK during the 1970s, when immigrants of color from former colonies were coming to work there by finding little opportunity. That's in 10 minutes.
When you make a gift of $100 a month to Wisconsin Public Radio, you're not only making a decision to support your values, you're also making a commitment that helps keep WPR strong today and for years to come. Because you can't imagine your day without WPR, consider a gift of $100 a month to support your favorite station. Your gift will have significant impact. To make your gift, go to WPR.org and click donate. Thank you.
News in Washington, I'm Jim Kane. Turkish media reports several counterterrorism raids have netted at least 5 suspected ISIS supporters. NPR's Peter Kenyon says they're alleged to have been planning attacks around a referendum vote set for Sunday.
Police launched raids in a number of Anatolian cities, rounding up suspects who reportedly were planning attacks this weekend as Turks prepare to go to the polls. They'll be deciding whether to take the strong executive powers currently held by the prime minister and give them to the president. President Recep Tayyip Erdogan is campaigning hard for the changes.
In Afghanistan, the government says the 22,000-pound bomb dropped by the U.S. military killed 36 ISIS fighters. The Pentagon says it targeted the largest conventional bomb ever used in combat at a network of caves and tunnels used by ISIS. French judges are asking the European Parliament to lift the immunity of far-right lawmaker and presidential candidate Marine Le Pen over suspected misuse of parliamentary salaries. Joanna Kakissis has more from Paris.
Le Pen is a member of the European Parliament and is suspected of recruiting parliamentary aides on EU salaries to do work for her party, the Anti-Immigration National Front. The accusations, which Le Pen says are unfounded, come just over a week before the first round of the presidential race.
Anti-death penalty activists are planning a demonstration outside the Arkansas governor's mansion to protest the state's plans to execute 7 inmates before the end of the month. I'm Jim Kane, NPR News in Washington.
This is Wisconsin Public Radio News at 8:43. I'm Maureen McCollum. The state appeals court this week handed a significant setback to the proposed Golden Sands mega dairy farm in the Wood County town of Saratoga. As Glenn Moberg reports, the dairy may appeal the ruling to the state Supreme Court.
The court said the dairy had the right to put buildings on its land, but it does not have the right to spread manure on thousands of acres away from the building site. Paul Kent is an attorney for the town of Saratoga.
The court stated in a couple of places that they could find no precedent to support the dairy's position.
But Golden Sands owner Jim Wysocki said in a written statement that the court had changed the rules in the middle of a 4.5-year process and that justice this slow is not justice. Rhonda Carell, founder of the group Protect Wood County and its neighbors, said she wants to sit down with Jim Wysocki.
Jim, we all need water. We need to share it, and let's find a way to resolve this. Let's sit down at the table and figure out how to let all of us move forward with our lives.
Wysocki may appeal to the state Supreme Court. Glenn Moberg, Wisconsin Public Radio News.
Janesville fugitive Joseph Jakubowski has been captured in Vernon County. The Rock County Sheriff's Department said he was found camping on a farm in Reedstown this morning. Law enforcement took him into custody without incident. Jakubowski is suspected of robbing a gun store in southern Wisconsin and making unspecified threats against schools. He also sent an anti-government manifesto to the White House. Dozens of police and federal officials have been searching for him since last week. This is WPR News.
Support for NPR comes from NPR member stations and from the Economic Development Authority of Fairfax County, Virginia, where a new Center for Personalized Health is working to predict and prevent cancer. Details at powerofideas.org. From the Maine Office of Tourism, offering travelers an opportunity to explore and discover their very own Maine thing, to be inspired, be original, and be yourself at mainequarterly.com. And from the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, helping NPR advance journalistic excellence in the digital age.
This is Morning Edition on Wisconsin Public Radio, and now it's time for Wisconsin Life. Here's executive producer Erica Janik on Reflections of Motherhood.
For many years, Sagacious Levingston felt like she was faking motherhood. The women she knew looked nothing like the mothers in books and on TV, and she felt like she was constantly failing to live up to what other people thought she should be. Rather than keep trying to change, though, Levingston decided to change the story with a group she called Infamous Mothers.
I've come from four generations of sex workers. My great-grandma was a sex worker. My grandma was a sex worker. My dad was part of the sex industry. My sister was part of the sex industry. I knew that that wasn't for me, but I still found myself engaging in risky behavior, and I was having all of these children, and I didn't have the self-esteem to protect myself because I felt like, well, if I do this, then this person's not going to want to be with me, then I can't get the validation that I need, then I can't go through the world being smart because I have to get the validation first, then I can be smart, right? So there was this whole process that I was trying to go through, and I had to overcome that. One day I had to wake up and say, I have this string of kids. And, you know, when you mess up one kid, you can blame the kid. The kid was a fluke, right? But if you mess up five, folks are like, who is your mama? Who did this? And unleash these folks into the world, right? So I looked up, and I had all of this responsibility, and I had to do something about it. I didn't see stories like mine. You know, one of the things that I say a lot is that I found myself and women like me amputating parts of myself, ourselves, to fit into these neat boxes. And after a while, you cut off enough pieces, there's just nothing left. When I started this research, I was interested in all mothers, right? And I'm still interested in all moms. But what I noticed was the women who were damaged most by the mothering narratives were moms like me, moms who had come from impoverished Black backgrounds, moms who had multiple children by multiple men, moms who were teen moms or moms who were on drugs. So any mom that I can imagine was in my community was the ones who were really damaged by the mothering narrative. So I knew that if I could help empower that group of mom, it would kind of trickle up. I grew up around amazing women, amazingly. Oh, God, I'm about to cry just thinking about these women. Where I come from, women on the south side of Chicago, women in low-income housing. What I experienced with moms who were tough. Tough was their love. Tough was their form of love. Their mothering met the intensity of that environment. So my name is interesting, right? My mom has a college degree. My dad, who has no college degree, used to read the dictionary, and he named me Sagacious. And I asked my dad, why did you name me Sagacious? Because I'm the only one in my I have 11 other siblings. Their names are like Chandra, Sean, Kyle, Paul, Isaac, right? I'm the only sagacious, right? So why me? And my dad said, because I wanted you to live up to your name. That was important to me. And so as time went on, when I became an adult, I said, Dad, there's a word right across from my name, salacious. You know, one letter different, it would have been the pole for me, Dad. I would have been right there swinging on the pole, right? And here I am at the podium, right? Like, that was one letter different. And then I realized that he understood that, and that name was very intentional. By the time he got to me, he was saying, enough. There's something that's happening in our family. And if I call you something different, if I call you wise every day, then maybe you'll rise. There's something really humbling when you carve out a space for yourself and then other women say, this fits me too.
Sagacious Levingston is the founder of Infamous Mothers. Wisconsin Life is a co-production of Wisconsin Public Radio and Wisconsin Public Television in partnership with the Wisconsin Humanities Council. Additional support comes from Lowell and Mary Peterson of Appleton. I'm Erica Janik.
It's 10 minutes before 9 o'clock, and this is Morning Edition on Wisconsin Public Radio. Coming up, there's a new release to sample, music for Good Friday, and that's all ahead on Morning Classics with Stephanie Elkins, followed by pianist Mark Valenti, live on the midday. Music starts right after the 9 o'clock headlines, and there's more for Morning Edition next here on WPR.
Support for WGTD comes from Carthage College, providing graduate and accelerated certification programs in education to start or advance a career in teaching. More information is available online at carthage.edu/grad.
Discoveries, helping us know not only what's happening, but why. It's the whole picture. This is NPR.
There's a chance of rain showers through the day today and a slight chance of thunderstorms this afternoon. Highs will be near 60 degrees, except in the lower to mid-60s near Lake Superior.
Support for WPR comes from Oakwood Village Rehabilitation Services at University Woods on Madison's west side and Prairie Ridge on the east side. Both campuses support patients with dedicated and talented staff focused on achieving a complete recovery.
Support for WGTD comes from Piasecki Outhouse, hosting Grief Share, a 13-week support group program for adults grieving the death of someone close, running every Wednesday, March 8th through May 31st, 5:30 until 7 p.m. Register by calling 262-658-4101.
This is Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm David Green.
And I'm Steve Inskeep. A few years ago, the American screenwriter John Ridley was working in Britain. He learned a bit of history that was new to him, yet felt familiar. It was the story of a time in the 1970s when Britain struggled with that American-sounding question, who are we?
There came a point where there was issues of immigration and who was really British and who belonged in this country. All of those things that were embedded, things that I was completely unaware of.
John Ridley has now written and directed a Showtime series about that moment. It's the story of a time when Britain welcomed immigrants of color from former colonies to work, but did not give them many opportunities. One scene shows a well-educated black man talking, we think, to a white man at an employment office about getting a teaching job.
I'd be very interested in placement in university education. Not that I wouldn't consider something at a secondary school, but I think I'd have
more
to offer.
You have a license?
I have a degree in...
Do you have a driving license? I could get you something in transport straight away. Now, if you can't drive, there's a desperate need for porters, but you seem like one of the smart ones, and I'd like to get you something good. Can you drive then?
This man and others gradually turn toward violent solutions. By the end of the first episode, they've broken a radical black leader out of prison, which is why the show is called Guerrilla. John Ridley is the screenwriter of 12 Years a Slave. Now he's created a series about a black man and an Indian woman, both immigrants to a white society. There is a reason that Ridley shows the teacher humiliated at that employment agency desk.
One of the things that was very important to us, frankly, was to not do a show about crazy people of color grabbing guns and to show people who have struggled as best they could to be part of the system, to contribute, to have value. But unfortunately, in our country, in America, and in the UK at that time period, there were lines that were drawn. People were not interested in what you could potentially do. They were only interested in what they thought one could do.
The man behind the desk, I said he's a white man. I guess we don't literally know that. We never even see him. We just hear his voice.
Yeah, you know, part of, for me, the language of cinema is to take the opposition and in some ways reduce who they are. Sometimes the opposition that some of us face, all of us face in some ways, in different ways, you know, is faceless. It's systemic. And everybody faces that system in different ways based on, you know, it could be race, could be class, could be faith, it could be orientation. But there's moments where you're sitting somewhere trying to participate and the person on the other end, they can't see you.
So he ends up responding by going to extremes. And let's play a little bit more of this. He's talking with his partner, Jazz, and they are discussing whether to begin committing violent acts. Let's listen.
I'm not afraid of prison, are you?
You don't get to shame me into doing something mental, Jazz.
All the speeches, the empty rhetoric, they do nothing. They do nothing. We need to do something.
What did you do to get into the frame of mind of someone who ends up committing violence?
It was difficult because for me, I very sincerely, I don't think violence is a solution. I don't think it's an answer, but I think we see time and time again that when real, positive, long-term solutions are not presented to people, there are individuals who will turn to violent acts. What was very important, and is, I think what was represented in that scene, it wasn't a sudden jump. It wasn't as though these two individuals woke up and said, we're going to do this. And she is a nurse. You know, she is a person who wants to, her objective is to care for people. So how do you get from a space where that's your drive as a person to care to a space where you feel like the only thing you can do is pick up arms against the empire?
In writing about immigration and race in a different place and time, did you intend to comment on the United States right now?
No, this story, you know, honestly, it was something that was fascinating to me when I was a kid. It was something that I felt deserved further exploration as I got older. It was a project that I started working on in earnest almost 10 years ago. And despite the fact that the setting was more than 40 years ago, there are elements that people can draw a direct parallel to between what happened then and what happened now. That's without any effort. And that tells me there is a problem with our current set of circumstances. When immigration, when demonization, when marginalization is still the norm.
What is the problem?
Listen, the people who are far smarter, sharper, shrewder than I am, very seriously, look, immigration, there are true, legitimate issues with how we deal with how people travel between nations and seek out an other, different, better life for themselves. That's the history of the world. But the prevailing culture often find ways of saying that's wrong, you're wrong, and as I say, demonize those individuals.
You constantly dig into heavy subjects. Does it drag you down?
It does. I mean, I can't lie to you. I try to make it less about me, and I try to make it more about other people and their lives and their experiences, and you end up realizing that you're carrying around a lot of things that other people have trusted you with and that you have an obligation to try to get it right. But at the same time, I've been blessed. I've been truly blessed with having the opportunity to put stories into the culture that other people seem to either actively ignore or be afraid to speak to. Compared to what other people do or compared to what my parents did so that I may do this, it's pretty easy.
John Ridley, it's been a pleasure talking with you again.
Steve, thank you very much, as always.
John Ridley is the writer behind the new miniseries Guerrilla. The first episode appears on Showtime this Sunday night. This is Morning Edition from NPR News. Our theme music was written by B.J. Lederman and arranged by Jim Pugh. I'm Steve Inskeep.
And I'm David Green.
Hey, And you can hear Morning Edition from 5 until 9 on weekdays and starting at 7 a.m. on Saturdays and Sundays. There are headlines in a minute and stories at WPR.org, including breaking news this morning about the Janesville fugitive. He has just been caught, and you can find all of the details at WPR.org.
Support for WPR comes from SFM Mutual Insurance, focused on workers' comp programs with a commitment to creating long-term positive results for employers and their employees. SFMWorkersComp.com.
Healthy fresh produce is starting to arrive at Kenosha Winter Harbor Market, open Saturdays in the lobby of the Rotary from 10 until 2. This week featuring Right Way Farm, bringing in greenhouse-grown microgreens, spinach, and kale. The market is a proud supporter of WGTD. You're listening to WGTD HD, Kenosha.